Okay, I think we're ready to get underway. Welcome everyone to this afternoon's council work session. These are informal work sessions in which the council gets briefed and gets into depth with questions on issues and programs. We don't take testimony, but we're glad you're here to listen to the discussion. We have some presentations lined up. I won't deliver an elaborate preface just this much, and that is, over the last couple of years, there's been a great focus here at the city and with our partners on housing and homelessness. We have just celebrated the completion of our successful effort to meet the President's Veterans Challenge, where we started last year with 690 homeless veterans and housed 695. And that's a great accomplishment, and it's proof that we actually can move the needle on these issues. So, yeah, worth celebrating. And secondly, the council has devoted a great deal of attention to funding affordable housing efforts, and we've made some progress there, including devoting now 45% of our tax increment funds to housing, which is an enormous lift in terms of the amount of funding that the City of Portland's committing to affordable housing efforts in the years to come. We have been focusing a lot lately on the next phase of homelessness, which is more shelter space. And in the now 4 months since the council declared a state of emergency, we've opened 400 shelter beds, albeit some of them temporary, and obviously not enough. But it also, again, demonstrates that progress is possible and that shelter beds are needed. Josh Alpert, my chief of staff, is going to lead this discussion this afternoon. He has many responsibilities, but lately it seems like this issue and working on this issue and orchestrating progress on this issue is about 90% of his job, and his job is more than 100% of him. So we appreciate, Josh, the effort, and you and Mark and the other people that are going to facilitate this discussion and putting into this effort. And with that, I'll turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you, Mayor and Commissioners, for the opportunity to present to you today. I'm going to just set the stage a little bit and then turn it over to Mark to also set the stage a little, and then we'll go through the presentation. We'll have several people coming as invited testimony throughout. I look at this, as I think most of us do, as a continuum, bookended by today and tomorrow. And I think we would all agree that tomorrow truly is one goal that the city has, which is to house permanently as many people as fast as we possibly can. Today is today, with roughly 2,000 people unsheltered on our streets. In between really is where the work happens. Most of that work is being done under Mark's leadership at A Home for Everyone, in conjunction with the Housing Bureau, most of our city bureaus, the county, and our other partners. The piece that we're going to talk about most today is today. The piece that we have bitten off in our office. Under no circumstances is anything that we're going to be discussing today a solution or an answer. It is merely a way to try and create some stability on the streets for people to wait comfortably, safely, while we build for tomorrow. So bear that in mind as we move forward, that none of these are being presented as solutions to anything other than trying to create some stability on the streets. Mark, I'll turn it over to you.
Mayor and Commissioners, thanks for having me. I really do just want to take one moment I'm sorry, I'm Mark Jolin, I'm the Initiative Director for Home for Everyone. Mostly to say that next week, next Monday, we actually have a work session on A Home for Everyone to talk about what we've already done over the past year with some of the investments that you made and the county made towards expanding shelter, towards expanding permanent housing placement, and towards affordable housing development, what we're looking forward to in this coming budget cycle, the kinds of recommendations that our work groups and coordinating board have made around expanded capacity to move people into permanent housing, ensure that they're able to stay in permanent housing. So that's the discussion that we'll have here next week with you under the Home for Everyone framework. I think it just goes to that continuum that Josh talked about, that today we're talking about the very immediate term, the work that we've been doing under Home for Everyone with you and with your partners around that table really is about where do we want to be over the next year, 2 years, 5 years on this issue of homelessness. So.
We've had, I should alert everybody, we've had a big technology upgrade, which means nothing works now. After we've had the discussion today and the discussion next Monday, just to set the expectations in the community, what do you envision as the next steps, including engaging the public in the specifics of anything that's on the table and the council's role in any decisions?
Commissioner, thanks for the question. Today is merely an opportunity to present all of this to council. Tomorrow is when the work truly begins of putting details to the plan to go ahead and start implementation. Nobody should be under the assumption that tomorrow we flip a switch and 2,000 people move from outside to inside. This will be incrementally implemented as many factors are considered. One, of course, is Mark and I continuing to do the roadshow of neighborhood associations, which we've begun to lay out plans. There are also other plans happening outside of this building with the community themselves getting together and meeting us where we are going as well. And so really pulling all of those conversations into this building to continue them together as we flesh out all the details that go forward into this plan will be the work ahead of us over the next few weeks. Some of this will be easier to implement and faster to implement than others, but we intend to have over the next several weeks all the details put together. That doesn't mean we have land to do all of these things or enough buy-in to go ahead and implement all of it immediately, but over the course of the next few weeks and hopefully the next few months, we'll be able to implement a good chunk of this moving forward. It is my hope that we can, as a body, study this. We're working on creating the metrics to do that now with the idea that for a period of time, say 6 months, we can go ahead and study while tinkering with it as it's happening. I've already had conversations with Chief O'Day and others and Commissioner Fritz to make sure that we're giving our own workers the ability to give feedback as our frontline workers out there and interacting with our folks on the street to make sure that they're affording us their insights as they go forward and do this. And so we'll be collecting and collating all of that information and tinkering with the plan as it moves forward to the point where we can come back to council as regularly as you want for updates, and then with the idea that, you know, in approximately 6 months, whether or not we would want to enshrine this as policy moving forward. So for now, it's experimental. We're going to see if this works, and if not, what we can do to change it so that it does work. Stay for a minute. I've set up the run of show for this work session to really reflect the continuum. And as Mark said, there's a work session next week that I look at as part two of this that will focus in more on the plans moving forward for Home for Everyone, the longer term plans, and the budget recommendations that would reflect that. Starting today, now, with really the first end of this, which I consider to be street management. Just to set the context, and I know that I've spoken with most of you about this, and I'm going to say it again because I think it bears repeating in order to frame the issue. On December 10th of last year, I was sitting in the Rose Room waiting for our West Coast Mayor Summit to begin. And if you recollect back to that week, it was a time when Johnson Creek was flooding, when we had horrific rain all over the city. And that particular morning, I remember well because my phone was ringing more so than it normally does at 7 in the morning. And it was advocates from all over the city asking why the city was out there moving people around when the weather was atrocious. And because I was waiting for this summit to begin, I didn't have a whole lot of time to get involved and figure out what was really going on. So I made a couple of quick phone calls, but then asked each bureau director to indulge us for a moment and stop what they were doing and instead email me directly and explain what they were doing, what they were trying to do and why, and who had asked them to do it so that we could get a better sense of what truly was actually happening. During that process, I learned relatively quickly over the span of 3 or 4 days, several things that I think are important to set the stage for this conversation. One, we as a city move people around every day pretty often. And that two, while everyone, every bureau was, of course, staying in conformance with the legal requirements, there were slightly different variations on criteria bureau to bureau and kind of why we were moving people around. And I reflected upon that and realized that as a relatively well-educated person who works at a high level in the city, I don't know when I'm out and about the city who owns what piece of land, whether even the city owns land, let alone which bureau does. And I thought, well, if we are telling people where they can and can't be and not informing them of what land is what or who owns what, then that was probably creating more confusion on the streets than less. I dug a little bit further and talked with my friends in the police bureau and others to get a little bit of history on how the system has evolved. And the system has been in place for a long time and has worked relatively well. We typically have taken an enforcement approach, and the theory behind that makes sense, that if you're trying to prevent bad things from happening on the street, trying to take away permanence seems like a good way of doing that. The more permanent people get, the more comfortable they get in one place over time. Those who are predisposed to do bad things more often than not will do them in that sense of permanence. And so over time, the city has taken a policy of disrupting that by constantly moving people. And as an enforcement mechanism, that's probably pretty sound. However, there's never been a way for police or others to distinguish on the street who is who. And we all know that the vast majority of people out there are truly, legitimately trying to find a place to sleep safely for the night. But because we've never been able to really distinguish who that is from anyone else, we've generally taken a blanket approach to that. I tested that theory a little bit, and I talked to some folks in the medical profession and others, experts in the field, to find out what that truly does to someone who already is in trauma. And I recognized that pretty quickly that there had to be ways where we could build a system that did a better job of distinguishing between those who are legitimately seeking safe sleep versus those who may be out on the streets and doing other things. That's where I came up with what I'll talk about shortly in terms of creating more options for people. But first, I wanted you to get a perspective from someone who works in the field, an expert on trauma-informed care, and really just to paint a picture of how blanketly moving people causes harm. So if Haven Wheelock is here. Great. Haven is from Outside In, but if you introduce yourself, that'd be great.
Okay, I'm scared of this technology. All right, cool. So, Mayor Hales, members of the council, I'm Haven Wheelock with Outside In. For those that don't know, Outside In has been in our community since 1968. We're an organization that works with homeless youth and other marginalized populations to move towards improved health and self-sufficiency. I've had the honor of working with them for the last 10 years and have been part of this community for that time, and I'm really honored to be here. Last year, Outside In served 800 homeless youth, and 6,000 people visited our medical clinic, half of whom are homeless. So we spend a lot of time working with people who are on the streets and who are dealing with health issues because of their time on the streets. Last year, Multnomah County Health Department and Street Roots put out a domicidal unknown report that showed that in 2014, 56 people died while homeless on the streets. The average age for those folks was 45 years old. It's nearly 30 years younger than the average life expectancy for most Americans. Sadly, 45 is the average life expectancy for people who are homeless. So the consequences of being homeless lead people to have all kinds of chronic stress and issues that come with chronic stress, as well as trauma, increased risk for violence, increased risk for accidents. As a primary healthcare clinic, one of the most troublesome issues that we see with sweeping homeless people actually is the loss of medications that people need to sustain life. It's a regular occurrence for people to come into our medical clinic requesting new medications and refills on their medications because their belongings have been thrown away and they no longer have access to these medications that they need. I recently spoke with a man who is a type 1 diabetic who had his blood sugar testing kit taken along with his insulin in one of these sweeps, and it led to an ER visit. He required transportation to the hospital in order to get his medication and his blood sugar stabilized. we hear about. It's not just injectable drugs that we hear about this with. We hear about it with antibiotics, heart medication, mental health medications that people really do need to prevent life-threatening illnesses. And some of these medications are easy to replace, right? Outside In has no problem refilling someone's prescription for antibiotics. But when you're talking about things like mental health medications and pain medications, things that are more controlled, are you coming back? All right. So having these medications taken from them may mean people are without their mental health meds for up to 2-3 weeks, depending on when the last time they had these medications refilled, because getting them refilled can be a barrier. About 79% of people who live outside will have symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. It's a huge number of people who So roughly about 79% of people who are homeless will have post-traumatic stress disorder. And with trauma, you're dealing with people who, it lowers their ability to interact in the community. It lowers their ability to actually build trusting relationships with their medical providers, with their case managers. These barriers can actually keep people further out on the streets and further out on the margins because these traumas that they're dealing with. And having your stuff taken is traumatic. Being woken up at 6 a.m. and being told that you need to move by crews of people who are coming in to take your stuff and to take the stuff of the people that are camped around you is something that truly does add to the lack of trust that people feel when they have trauma responses, makes it harder for them to reach out and to actually engage with people who are trying to be part of the solution. So,
let me just ask a question about that. Why is the stuff being taken from people who are with their stuff?
Say that again.
So you said that the people are woken up and then their stuff is taken. Why is their stuff taken
if
when
they Often what I'm hearing from folks is like they'll be woken up, they'll be told to leave, and anything that they can't carry with them at that moment is stuff that they will lose. So if you're talking about someone like me trying to move a large quantity of stuff, my bedroll, my tent, things like that, moving that stuff is actually tricky. I mean, I think we can all relate. We've all moved at one point in our lives and have felt that like constant anxiety that's happening while you're actually trying to move from one location to another. When you're homeless, you are constantly in that state of stress. So I just kind of want to wrap this up and answer any questions you all have, but I do not envy the work that you guys have in front of you. This is a really, really complex issue, and I think that being really mindful that, you know, I understand that stopping sweeps is not going to be the end all to this issue, but any of the upstream projects you are working on, as Josh was saying, those are all goals to work towards, but today we have people being traumatized on our streets. Today we have people at increased risk of violence because they're being asked to not camp with people around them and to, you know, be on their own as opposed to being safety of other people around them. So I look forward to answering your questions and good luck with this task because it's a big one.
So let me just ask another clarifying question. We are required by the state to take this stuff to somewhere. I understand that there's a barrier to then folks picking it up. Where is currently the place where people's stuff is taken?
Commissioner, I believe it's still in Southwest on Barber. Bob Gitta will be up in a little bit to talk about a different initiative, but he'll also be able to inform you if that's still there. I know we've been looking at trying to move it in closer, but I don't think we've done that quite yet.
Sorry about the system. I have a question about safety in camping. So I know there's lots of different views out there about what's an appropriate size of what's the sweet spot in terms of safety, but not by virtue of being too large, creating safety issues. And some of the data for me that's pretty alarming the likelihood of a woman who's homeless and on the streets being sexually assaulted within the first 24 to 48 hours, and then the vulnerability index. So I've heard lots of theories about size and scope. Do you have a personal opinion about what's the right size? If you're going to allow people to camp and have more than one person in an area for safety, what do you have your own sense of what's the sweet spot?
I think that's a really hard question because I think it depends on the individual and what they feel comfortable with. Some people prefer to be one, just a couple of people, or some people prefer that larger network of people. I think when you're thinking about camps of homeless people, remembering that people tend to try and sleep inside when they can. So, for instance, if I'm sleeping outside with, there's five tents set up at my camp, there's a good chance that three of those people may be in a hotel room for the night. They may have chose shelter, which would mean I would still be on my own outside. I know that like risk of sexual assault is something that we hear a lot. We've stopped asking in our programs, when was the last time you have you ever been sexually assaulted? The question we ask of women now is, when was the last time you were sexually assaulted? Because that is a real issue. I do vulnerability assessments through Outside In, and I would say I don't know that I've ever done a screening for someone who was female that has not reported sexual assault. And I've also heard many reports from males who have also been sexually assaulted. So it is a real concern. As for an actual number of where that balance is, because the population is constantly moving and shifting and people are, you know, moving around, not just because they're forced to, but because, well, if I got a free hotel room, I would sleep inside. And there is, I don't have the right answer.
Other questions for Haven? Great. Thank you, Haven.
Thank you.
So, bearing all of that in mind, my task was really to try and figure out what options can we put forward. I'm going to go through the options one by one, and feel free to stop me. Options. The first I call our safe sleep plan. And this is the general concept for anyone on the streets. Anyone on the streets now who simply is trying to figure out, what do I do if I want to sleep tonight outside in Portland? We, I believe, as a city, have all agreed that we have to provide places outside for people. It is our reality. We have typically any given night people sleeping all over the city, some of whom are on sidewalks. So with that in mind, we thought, okay, we should go ahead and allow people in the evenings to continue to sleep on sidewalks, but under no circumstances should they be putting up tents or other temporary or permanent structures on sidewalks within the city. So one option for people under our new safe sleep guideline would be to go ahead and use a sleeping bag or a tarp on the sidewalks roughly from the hours of 9 p.m. to 7 a.m., knowing as well that you cannot block an entire sidewalk, and in so doing, to have a very small group, generally six or fewer, with you. As Haven mentioned, we typically don't want people by themselves unless they feel comfortable and confident that they are able to sleep safely by themselves. So we tried to figure out a way to allow for very small groups for safety purposes to congregate together, but recognize the fact as well that sidewalks themselves are pretty limited in space. So by removing all structures, we figured one option would be to go ahead and allow people to lie down at night on a sidewalk.
Small ones take up too much space on a sidewalk that they don't allow other people to use the sidewalk. Sidewalks are public spaces. And so that was the thinking behind that.
Correct. That's correct.
So, Josh, when we talk about sidewalks, which sidewalks are we talking about? And recognizing that some sidewalk areas, if you allowed camping or other activity, would interfere with access routes to the sidewalk. Others are currently posted that limit the activity on those sidewalks, and there are others, there are other places, particularly in high visibility, high traffic places, where there are probably some additional safety issues. So are you going to walk us through which sidewalks?
Yeah, I wasn't going to get into that level of detail here, but I'm happy to. Yeah, conceptually, our guidelines incorporate the continuation of high pedestrian use zones that are, I think, the ones you're mentioning, that are marked and posted as inappropriate for people to congregate on. Those are the most visible ones. We have a chunk of them here downtown. But it's also something we're working with our outreach providers on, who will be really the front lines of helping people understand in this new system what can and can't be an acceptable use of sidewalks and other pieces of land. One way of doing that, and I'll read a of them handing out guidelines to people on the streets, and in it will say, please, if you see no high pedestrian use zones, that's not acceptable. So we'll be able to typically, most people who are looking for sidewalks areas, that's when the police will come and move them. So you'll see, by and large, people already kind of identifying places that tend to be more out of the way.
And the other thing, apart from police, is that other passersby are not always as friendly or as unharmful to those who are sheltering. So that's another reason that they try to not be in the high-density areas. That's
right, Commissioner. So that's still under option one. Our safe sleep plan is sidewalks. If you do need a tent to sleep, we did try and recognize that right as well, because it is Portland. We do get rain here. And if you're only allowing sleeping on sidewalks, most people are going to get wet and then potentially sick. So we wanted to create an avenue for people to go ahead and put up tents for a night. And the key component to this is the hours. We will be enforcing hours when you're allowed to have your tent up. It will be from, we think at the moment, 9 at 7 in the morning. Those areas around the city are typically rights of way, remnant pieces of property. I took a drive over the weekend and counted quite a few just in a very small proximity to my house of areas where I thought, sure, it would be perfectly acceptable to have 3 or 4 tents in this area under the right guidelines, which have been laid out in our new document. And those guidelines truly do focus around ensuring that those tents come down at 7 in the morning. As the city is now piloting, and albeit only 2-day storage units, we do believe that we'll be able to prove the concept and quickly scale up to allow more day storage all over the city, so that we can really go ahead and enforce that part of the regulation, that now that we are actually offering places for you to store your belongings so that you can go about your day doing the things that we all take for granted, that gives us more ability to say those tents have to come down every day, but you're welcome to go ahead and find space to put them back under the Safe Sleep Plan. And those are really the high points of that particular plan. And again, that's just for general sleeping on a night-by-night basis around the city. And again, in those small groups, generally 6 or fewer people, 6 or fewer structures, 1 structure to a person if you need to have a tent up, and the tents must come down every day.
Just to dwell on that point about the storage spaces for a bit, I mean, I think that having adequate storage for people without homes is critical, both for them and also, I think, that for community livability. I think a large part of what people perceive as, quote, the homeless problem is just seeing stuff lying around that makes them uncomfortable. But it was my impression that we've taken a long time just to identify a couple of storage spaces. It sounds like you're more optimistic that we might be able to scale up and have a number of them. Could you explain the reason for your optimism?
Yeah, it's taken us a little while to figure out the concept that we wanted to put forward and what we've decided. And Bob Keita will come up and a couple of different models right now based on locations, which is why we spent some time trying to figure out what we wanted to see and what we were trying to prove. One model, as Bob will go into more detail, is kind of the traditional model that we conceived of when we thought of this, which would be to put it in an area that is pretty rife with people sleeping on the street right now. That's the one under the steel bridge. Then we thought, well, we should also see, and this will be a good segue into the second of four options, whether it would make sense to have one of these located in an organized camp environment to see if it proves useful for the people staying there as well, under the theory that even putting your stuff for a day in your tent may not be the safest, most confident way for people to leave the area and go about seeking treatment and service and job interviews and all the things that people try and do during the day. So it's taken us a while to kind of get to that point. We're close to opening both of them up. We have operators we're working with right now to get them ready to go. And Bob, like I said, we'll talk a little bit more about that. But I think just based on feedback already, without them even being open, the need and demand will far outstrip any concerns that people generally have about them. We'll prove that hopefully over the next several months and then go ahead to scale. So true to the segue, after the Safe Sleep Plan, we're offering a structured, organized camping program. This is probably the most controversial of things that we'll have here to discuss, so I'll take a minute to kind of walk through how we got to this concept and how we envision it working. Obviously, with Hazelnut Grove primarily, and then the new camp Forgotten Realms, we've had an opportunity to experiment. And I certainly would be the first to say that we didn't do as good of a job on public process in that Hazelnut Grove situation as we probably should have. But we also didn't know it was really happening. People went to Hazelnut Grove and set up shop. It evidently had been happening for years. But there became an effort to organize and actually create capacity to get people to agree to a code of conduct and live in a community. If it could work, and so over the past 2 months or so, we've been very hands-on with Hazelnut Grove on trying to figure out whether even that model was worth exploring to create a system around. I believe the short answer to that is yes, and we've seen really good things come out of Hazelnut Grove. Again, the process of how we got there, I know, leaves a lot to be desired, but at that time, really trying to figure out just whether it would work or not was what we were interested in doing. I will say that Hazelnut Grove has now housed 9 people permanently out of that camp, which is actually above and beyond the system we had envisioned. So we're really happy to see that. And through some trial and error with the camp itself, we, I believe, got to a point that gave us confidence that we should actually get a large group of people together to see if we could build a system. And we've started that conversation with a few different meetings with providers and advocates, and now with neighborhoods as well. The idea behind this will be different than either Forgotten Realms or Hazelnut Grove in that there will be a series of requirements for any group that wants to self-organize and go ahead and create a temporary camp. The first and most important will be the need to have an affiliation with a known 501c3 here in Portland that has demonstrated experience in managing shelter, the equivalent of that. So Join, TPI, and our other providers have expressed interest in being part of those conversations and eventually becoming what I'm calling camp hosts that will really provide a management layer to an organized camping system. So if you can imagine this, this will be a permitted system by the city. We have 2 different kinds of permits that we're working on right now, one for Hazelnut Grove, one for Forgotten Realms. One's a permit, one's a use agreement just based on ownership of the land. But we have some legal framework models of which then the next step will be to sit down with stakeholders, including a coalition of neighborhoods that has created a work group to help us address this and figure out the system. But the permit, largely will be everything imaginable in it, quiet hours, how long can this camp exist for, efforts to get towards a good neighbor agreement with neighbors, the things generally that we've been discussing for Right to Dream. We took that as a model as well to really create a pretty comprehensive permit system that camps would be required to live under. And of course, a permit's revocable as well if things shouldn't work as planned. So that is on the horizon. We are meeting later this week, and then we'll be meeting probably twice a week for several weeks to craft the permit requirements with neighborhoods and with advocates as well, providers, and then move forward with identifying camp hosts. And then, of course, trying to figure out land for that. Land, as for all of these issues, will be at a premium and difficult to find, but I'm encouraged to know that the neighborhood associations themselves are starting to take up the question of whether there's land available in their neighborhood that they would offer up to the city for these purposes on a temporary basis. And it's really through that kind of partnership, we think, that can make this work. I think we could all argue all day long whether or not this is good policy or bad policy, and actually I'm not sure that we would even argue, because I don't know that this is good policy in any way, and yet I don't think we're in a policy framework right now other than trying to create the policy to allow it, to see if it works.
And just to clarify, in terms of neighborhood land, it's we're looking for property owners, churches, any property owners who would be willing to do this that neighborhoods might be able to suggest. Looking at remnants of right-of-way and various other places. We are not looking at parks for these permanent campsites.
That's correct, Commissioner. There will be no sanctioned camping in parks anywhere in the city. This would be land identified by neighborhoods that would either be our own land that's not parks that we may not know about or haven't considered, or such as, you say, private land.
Can you just give us a sketch, or maybe Bob will, of what the basic sanitation requirements that we'd try to meet in terms of water and restroom facilities?
Yeah, Mayor, it's a great question and really illuminates why we, as a requirement of the system, have to have people coming to us rather than identifying and occupying land themselves. We ran into this and are still running into this with Hazelnut Grove, in that that would never have been land we would have probably sanctioned as appropriate for camping, because it's too hard to service. They, in fact, still don't have water at Hazelnut Grove. And so ideal land will at least be able to be serviced by us to create things like water, whether we have to bring a truck out or not. That was even difficult to do at Hazelnut Grove just based on the geography of that space. But ideally, it will be land that could be served if it doesn't already have access to water. We are going to be providing dumpsters and trash pickup, as well as porta potties, and likely will start circulating through a contract the mobile shower providers as well, so that everyone has an opportunity to take showers throughout the week on kind of a rotating basis around the city. But again, I mean, we're looking at starting very small with this because it's going to be complicated and require a lot of attention to the detail. And so as soon as we can figure out a piece of land that's appropriate, that has some neighborhood support to it, we'll go ahead and test the concept with a provider who we'll have chosen as a camp host, and then up. But I also want to be very clear that it's not envisioned, at least in my mind, that we'll have, you know, hundreds of camps around the city. But, you know, ideally, after starting with one, maybe adding a few more around the city, it's going to be challenging to even get to that number just based on the scarcity of land to allow this. But to the extent that we can, and that it's going to be working, that then provides a community for people to wait impatiently while we continue to go ahead and build.
Josh, to anyone who's listening to this presentation and is skeptical about the city's ability to manage this policy, I guess a reasonable question is, what other city has experimented with any of these elements, and what's been their experience?
A great question, Commissioner, and frankly, very few cities have actually gone to the detail level that we're trying to do in a managed camp situation, but there are some. Eugene certainly has done it with their tiny house village. Olympia has done it with Quixote Village, and they're all slightly different models. So we've been picking and choosing what we think are the best practices from those, and then not looking much further than our own city here in what we've learned from Dignity Village through Right to Dream and the work that they do, and trying to just pick things that we think are simple, not particularly complicated and workable, and putting that system together. Lots of people that I've been working with on this have taken field trips to look at all of those, Coyote Village and the one in Eugene as well. I've done significant research on the one out in Madison as well. And, you know, there are lessons learned from all of those that we're trying to use as best practice in moving this forward. But nothing will help us more than the experience of our own providers. And they've been incredibly helpful in the conversations in terms of what their own capacity is to do this. The question earlier that you asked of Haven about the number, I was going to jump in, but thought I would wait till this portion to say that's really, you know, we've been kind of saying, well, 20 to 25 seems like a manageable number, but that's going to have to really have input from the providers themselves.
Josh, let me ask you a provocative question, which is designed to get at the other alternatives you've looked at. I'll just put it very simply. President calls Charlie tomorrow and says 2,000 Syrian refugees are coming here. They have no clothing, no money, no food. They don't speak the language. What would we do differently under those circumstances than treating the 2,000 people that are almost like our urban refugees under this policy?
Well, I can start to answer that question because, as a matter of fact, a Syrian refugee family is arriving at Portland Airport tonight, and I'm going to be meeting them. But because we have a well-developed system, they've already been provided with housing and supportive services, and that's how refugees arrive in this country. So we are actually doing, as a country and as a culture, what we should be doing for refugees. In a more generous age than ours, we dealt differently with homeless people. You know, a long time ago in this community, there were poor people, destitute people, and the county built a facility where they would live and farm. It was called Edgefield Manor. We're actually doing a much poorer job at the local level than the federal system is doing for refugees. By the time they've gone through that gauntlet of qualifying for residency in the United States, they have already, when that family arrives tonight, they have long since been provided with housing and services and employment training and other tools that will enable them to become productive citizens.
Let me pose it a little differently. I think one of the things that concerns me about this approach is I wonder whether we have the bandwidth and the expertise to do the oversight we need to keep faith with people that may give us some flexibility in trying something new and different, but are going to be skeptical as we move forward. There's only one Josh.
You wouldn't know it.
Or maybe there's more than one, but we think there's only one. Bob Keat is a wonderful guy, but this is not his core expertise. This OMF is not in the business of doing this. You mentioned nonprofit partners we might work with, and you mentioned the gold standards, but they also are buried in other work doing triage work. So let me ask you something. Why haven't we asked Mercy Corps, which manages these kinds of issues globally, to be our domestic lead in treating this as if it was a refugee resettlement crisis?
Thank you, Commissioner. We have, and they have turned us down on that, as has Red Cross, who, in fact, has gotten out of the shelter providing business for our winter warming shelter that they did provide. And I think it's a matter of capacity and mission for those organizations as well, which is why we've had to step into the breach more than I think any of us thought that we would. Those were the first places that we went when we tried to figure out how do we actually handle what we consider to be a domestic crisis here on our own soil. And they, frankly, just weren't up to the challenge. And I agree with you, this is well beyond our own capacity, mine included, which is why, one, we're starting very small to prove the concept, and then we can only go so far as our partners have the capacity and interest to do it. Of course, there will be budget requests that go along with this to help them expand capacity to the extent needed to go ahead and march down the field into doing something like this, but everyone should be on alert that by no means is this going to be something that's going to allow for the majority of our homeless population to go into organized camping, because we don't yet have the capacity to go ahead and do that. All we're trying to do is figure out, is this a viable model for us to look at investing further in as we move forward?
a couple of just practical issues. Currently, the decision to sweep or not sweep is run through the mayor's office, and I guess we've made you the czar for now. That doesn't quite comport with our charter. So going forward, how will the decision be? One of the things that I hear you saying loud and clear here is that if we establish a set of rules and require people to follow them, that to those people that don't follow the rules, that we might have more flexibility in addressing those issues, legally and also from other points of view. So what do you envision as the decision-making tree, both for any future sweeps that come up for whatever reason, and they're usually for health and safety reasons, not to punish anyone who's on the street, I hope. And second, what is the role of the individual commissioner in charge in terms of the approval process for any land that's being considered?
Great question, and Lord knows I do not want to continue being in charge of authorizing sweeps. After lots of consultation with our city attorneys, we in our office have the authority to lay out guidelines, and every commissioner in charge of your bureaus has the authority to exempt your bureaus from following these guidelines. And that will be a commissioner-specific decision. Any sweeps moving forward, and there will be, of course, we'll continue to do enforcement. All of these options, and I'll come back to this in a second, all of these options are just options for people who don't generally want to be caught up in those. But clearly, things will go back to the system that we've had in terms of bureaus themselves working through OMF, and the process will continue as it had. The only reason I intervened in that was simply to collect the data to figure out what was happening with our existing system and what changes we felt should be made moving forward to try. So everything will return back, and as the commissioner in charge of PES or water, you're free to say, you know what, I'm not comfortable with this, and I don't want anyone using my land whatsoever. If there happen to be encampments, you go through the same process you've always gone other than the past 6 weeks.
And Josh, I appreciate this discussion because you've been very transparent the last week, engaging all of us and working through this, and it's hard stuff. The Home for Everyone is our big collaborative oversight body for addressing housing and homelessness issues. Are we going to hear from our coalition partners on this, or can you represent where they are, and it's the city, the county, and Home Forward, and have they helped shape this policy, and have they expressed reservations along the way that we should know about?
Well, and I can ask Mark to come up and give a better answer, but many of the things that we've been working on have come through recommendations from the Safety Off the Streets Committee, which is a committee of A Home for Everyone. Shannon Singleton from JOIN is the head of that committee. She can't be here today at the last minute, but Shannon has been with me every step of the way trying to conceive this these sets of options, that most of which have come through the Home for Everyone committee, not necessarily to the level of detail that we now have before us, or the level of detail we're going to get to later on this week when we all sit down to work it through. But Home for Everyone, as you know, is a group of committees that really span the continuum. Only one of which, Safety Off the Streets, really deals with this particular piece, which is why I had Shannon really helping me try and craft this, so that we were reflective of the deliberations that that committee had been making.
Josh, I have two wildly different questions. I want to ask both of them just so I don't forget one of them. One is that I think we will hear from people in the community that, well, let's say you have a group that agrees to a code of conduct, et cetera, and does even if that group adheres to its code of conduct, I mean, they'll say, first of all, we won't know if they're adhering to it, and if there's unpleasant or threatening behavior in the vicinity of that camp, then it might be impossible to determine whether it was somebody who's formerly part of the camp or not. And other people also say that, well, other people, even if everybody in the camp is abiding by the code of conduct, the fact that they're there might somehow attract others who are not going to follow that code of conduct. So that's my one big question. What's the response to that? The other big question I had is there's been a lot of discussion about one big publicly owned facility as a shelter, that mass shelter, that being Wapato. And I've heard the experts explain why that's a bad idea. There's another rather large facility that the city owns that is more centrally located, which is Memorial Coliseum. And I was wondering if any thought has been given to using that as a mass shelter.
Yeah, I may let the mayor answer the second question, although I'll take a stab at it. But let me first address your first question, Commissioner. As I said, we've learned a lot in watching and working with Hazelnut Grove, Forgotten Realms, and you know all the other research we've done with Dignity and other organized camps. And the single most important thing that we did at Hazelnut was create the fencing, because as true to form, as you said, we saw once Hazelnut went ahead and organized and had their code of conduct, it did attract many, many other people, upwards of, you know, another 75 people on that property. By going ahead and fencing it and relocating Forgotten Realms, we were able to restore order back to that camp. And so now, moving forward, in fact, Forgotten Realms was fenced today. And it's largely for that reason, to create a defined boundary of people who have decided to self-organize and follow codes of conduct. We will always, I have no doubt, always hear from neighbors, concerned citizens, the public at large, when things are going badly. And of course, it's really hard at times for us to attribute it to any particular group or person, but we always try and investigate that to figure out if we can. But we also shouldn't underestimate the ability and desire of people on the street themselves to self-police. This is something I learned really true to form from Right to Dream, in that they do a phenomenal job of making sure that not only their encampment, their rest area, but the entire block around them is safe, and that they're being good neighbors, because they know that anytime anything bad happens, they're going to be on the front line and really taking the heat for that. And so they try very hard within the homeless community to ask people to be respectful and responsible and self-police themselves. And that's an ethic that really is starting to become paramount in the conversations that we've been having with advocates. Mayor, do you want to answer the memorial calls?
Yeah, I'd add this, Steve, and that is, I don't know much about being homeless, and I don't know much about running homeless shelters, though I've learned a lot, you know, in the last few months as we took the Sears building and turned it into a temporary shelter facility, and as the Menasche family stepped up and opened a men's shelter, and as Multnomah County did this amazing transformation of a former strip club into a family shelter. And then we went down and visited Commissioner Saltzman and Josh and Mark and I and others went down and using. And George Diemendorf from Transformation Projects is here and could do a better job answering this than me. It's always true that the old saying that to every big complex problem there's an answer that's simple and wrong. And the simple wrong answer, I think, to homelessness is that a big giant mass shelter, whether it's at Wapato or at Memorial Coliseum or some hangar we could find somewhere, would solve the problem. I don't know what the right upper limit is, but my sense in having seen these facilities in operation now, the about 160 people at Sears, 100 men in that shelter from the Menasche family, about 100 capacity at the model facility that we saw in San Francisco that we deliberately want to emulate, there's a social limit to the size of these facilities. And again, George and others here could probably do a better job of informing this than I could, but I certainly have that sense that there is certainly a point at which it's just too big to manage, because we're talking about people, and people are going to interact, and there's just a scale problem there. So I think we're going to address the shelter problem in our community by finding more spaces of a manageable size than finding a mega facility where we say, eureka, that's it. Finally, we've got the place where we can put 1,000 people inside. I don't think we end up with a viable community for more than a night or two if we've got 1,000 people under one roof. Just
Mayor,
my impression.
If I could just, Sally Erickson's here, and she's done groundbreaking work on this for a long time. And the reality is there's a percentage of people outside that we can't get inside with shelter. And it could be because of barriers in their own lives. It could be because of stereotypes about shelters. It could be about just not wanting to be around people. So there's a percentage of people that are very difficult to get in. And then almost invariably, large-scale shelters have been discredited. New York City proved the point in the 70s and 80s, and we've really moved beyond that. So that's not an option. And the other thing that, and I'll come back to this later because this greatly concerns me, at what cost? What's missing in this discussion, in my opinion, and I'll come back if I could have a minute at the end, Josh, is the opportunity cost. We are getting perilously close to investing in the wrong thing that doesn't actually match with what the solution is if we want to get people off the street and into self-sufficiency. And we're going to have some hard conversations about that. Maybe a preview for next Monday. But I really feel there's a divide here, a disconnect. And I just want to caution people. A lot of my friends, a lot of very well-intentioned people keep saying, just expand our shelter capacity and all will be well. And everybody here is committed to making sure that people have what we enjoy, which is a roof, not a tent, over our heads. And a shelter can only be a transitional house. It can only be better than the street. The only moral justification is it's better than the street, and it is a short-term path to something stable. I want to come back to what I think is the mismatch in terms of what we're investing in that provides a place for someone to land out of the shelter, and that, I think, is becoming an acute problem.
Thank you, Commissioner, and I won't take more time going down that path at the moment because we're going to have George come up and talk a little bit about the two shelters that we have operating right now that started that are temporary. But I will urge you to look at the model in San Francisco at the Navigation Center because the key, and there are several keys that make it work, but in my mind, the biggest key is that no one leaves that shelter without permanent housing. And they move them through fairly quickly because they arranged with their providers of permanent supportive housing and other housing to reserve bed spaces for people coming out of that shelter. And that's a critical piece that we don't currently have here. Because I agree with you, we can landing places for people out of it. So,
just to preview, Josh, the city currently has about 700. And a good day, we set a goal of 5% in our RFPs. And if you start extrapolating from that, we're not even getting close to meeting the demand.
That's right.
And I think that's going to require us to have some hard conversations about how we structure RFPs with our nonprofit friends and how we work with groups like Home Forward to make sure that we have the service dollars so we can do the permanently supportive housing units.
Yeah, I agree completely. I'm going to keep moving so we can get through this. One last piece on the organized camping. There is a discussion right now whether we end up on this or not. I don't know, but I believe we will, which is to provide standardized housing within the camps. And by that, I mean pods. Director Merlo from Emergency Management, I, Mark Joel, and others have been on the hunt for the billions of companies now manufacturing kind of disaster relief pods and other kinds of housing that we're going to need at some point down the road anyway. And so we've been vetting which companies and looking at different models to purchase now with the short-term use of potentially using for camps and the longer-term use, of course, for our pending disasters when they happen. So stay tuned for that. So the third of the four options, again, we have the safe sleep plan, we have an organized camping plan. Number three, probably the least developed at the moment, but right on the heels of the organized camping plan is an organized car RV camping plan. Now, that will largely look the same as the organized camping plan, but with a wrinkle in that a lot of it will be scattered site, and we are working now again with faith communities and others to use parking lots for a car here, a car there kind of model back in the neighborhoods, but this time with the neighborhoods at the table working with us through that so that we can site these and get them off the roads and into safer areas. Of potties and sanitation for folks as well as needed. So we're working on that. There are a lot of models we've been stealing from. Eugene has had theirs on the books for roughly 15 years and works really well. So we're looking at that and taking components out of that. Seattle just started theirs about 2 weeks ago, and already we're learning some best practices of things that they've done right and wrong.
So on that, I looked into that some time ago. It turns out the ordinance that Commissioner Fish passed is still in effect. So I have been directing folks to friendly faith organizations for the past couple of years. There are buildings where people are staying in the cars overnight.